radio frequencies and some integer value. So you end up with this spacing between the two adjacent co-modes, and also this offset frequency of this whole thing. And so if you can count and control these two radio frequencies, then in principle, you know every frequency inside the comb. And the way to think about these, I think, at least in terms of the way I like to think about it, is in terms of this being a really good synthesizer. It allows you to relate optical frequencies to microwave frequencies so you can make absolute frequency measurements, as we've talked about quite a bit yesterday. And also it allows you to relate to optical frequencies, right? So you can relate to optical frequencies whose separation is much, much larger than you can count the beat note directly with. And the result of this course is that optical frequencies are among the most precise measurements in all of science now. So if you want to do something really precise, frequency combs are a good way to approach them. So before I start talking about lithium, I want to sort of set an accuracy scale here and sort of talk about where the experimental lithium is and also where these combs are. And so this is an Allen variation plot. We saw some of these yesterday in some of the clock talks. And I've put on a few different frequency standards. So if you just buy a SRS commercial rubidium clock and steer it to GPS, it averages down something to a little bit better than a few parts in 10 to the minus 13 if you average long enough. If you're at NIST and you have access to the hydrogen masers, you get something that averages down very quickly at short time scales but starts to drift a little bit at longer time scales. And of course, the NIST F2, the fountain clock, comes in somewhere down there. The single ion clocks come in starting down to sort of the few times 10 to the minus 17 level, and the neutral atom clocks like ytterbium and strontium that we saw yesterday come down even lower. So on this scale, where does the frequency comb live? Right. How accurate is the frequency comb? And this is a question that came up when I was a postdoc at NIST working on these single ion clock comparisons, because Till Rosenband, who was the driving force of the aluminum ion clock while I was there, came and said, well, how do you know your clock's good? And so it came up with this question with how do you test the accuracy of the comb? How accurate are these? Is this synthesizer? And what we did was we decided to measure two really, really well. So what we did was we took a comb and we stabilized the offset frequency. So we stabilized one of our parameters to the comb. And we took a laser, a YAG laser, because we happen to have one lying around. We didn't stabilize it at all. It was just a free-running laser. And we stabilized a single mode of the frequency comb to this YAG laser. So once you've done that, you've completely fixed the comb. So we're not stabilizing the rep rate, we're stabilizing a single comb, and we're stabilizing the offset frequency. Well, then you can double that frequency of the YAG laser, and assuming that this doubling crystal is really a truly frequency doubling, your crystal, then you know what the beat frequency will be if you interfere it with another mode of the comb. So that's what we did. We doubled this output. We can relate this output to the beat frequencies we know, the F0 and the F beat, and the double beat frequency will be twice the beat frequency that we're stabilizing in the infrared plus this offset frequency. And if you do this, you can average this down and see how good your comb is, and it's really remarkable. It's quite a bit lower than the accuracy of these clocks, and is going to be lower. Well, they make pretty good progress on these clocks, but it's going to be lower for a few years at least. So this is really limited basically by our devotion to doing it. You know, we basically came down here and were able to show this to Till and say, yeah, come back to us in a few orders of magnitude and ask again. But this was really limited by our synthesizer, the RF synthesizers and the counting processes. Okay, so here's the scale of types of uncertainties you can get at. Oberlin College is a liberal arts college, so I don't have access to a fountain clock or these single ion clocks. But I do have access to a rubidium clock, and so the sort of the stability of the type of measurements that I've been able to do at Oberlin are kind of up at this range. And so in this range, where you have a commercial rubidium clock steered to GPS, what can you do? What's a useful thing to look at, and what can you possibly do? Well, as I said, I mean, the accuracy of the comb gives you these wonderful clock comparisons that we heard quite a bit about yesterday. But the other thing you can do is you can look at spectroscopy of very simple systems. So the system that is the simplest is hydrogen. Right? And hydrogen has been studied quite a bit with this idea of doing the spectroscopy of something that we think we understand really, really well. And this has led to a lot of really interesting results and some kind of excitement in the field. You can look at things like the proton radius and the Rydberg constant and really test quantum electrodynamics at a fundamental level. And as many of you, I'm sure, are aware, the proton radius is a bit of a question right now. Right? You can do this experiment in hydrogen. You can also scatter electrons off the proton to figure out how big the proton is. And you can also look at muonic hydrogen. So instead of having an electron, you have a muon. And the muonic hydrogen, you can do spectroscopy on. And the results don't agree. Right? There's a 7-sigma disagreement between the proton radius as determined by muonic hydrogen as compared to the normal hydrogen and the scattering experiments. So what other types of systems can you look at? Well, the system I want to talk to you about today is lithium. Right? And lithium is an interesting system because it's still a very simple system. It's a 3-electron atom. And it's simple enough that you can actually get a lot of information about nuclear structure. And you can test atomic calculations and how the quantum electrodynamics effects are included in the calculations. So this is sort of a different way at getting at some sorts of fundamental physics, although not the types of physics that we've been talking about most of this workshop. Okay,
unfortunately, they wouldn't be able to replicate any measurements with muonic lithium
but you could imagine doing a hydrogenic like lithium, right? I mean, lithium 3+ or 2+, 3+. Okay. So why lithium? Well, as I said, the calculations are very accurate. And you can do the calculations in lithium in a different way than is typically done in heavier elements. Particularly, you can actually do a non-relativistic calculation and figure out what the non-relativistic solutions to the Schrodinger equation are, and then add the relativistic corrections. Right? So this is different than what you would do with an atom like cesium, where you have to start with the relativistic effect because you're never going to be able to add the relativistic corrections in. So what can you look at? Well, the fine structure is an interesting thing to look at because the fine structure, of course, is a relativistic effect. And it really does give you the sensitivity to how well these quantum electrodynamic effects for these many-body bound state systems are being included in the structure calculations. The other nice thing about lithium is that there are two stable isotopes. There's lithium-6 and lithium-7. And if you look at the isotope shifts between these different isotopes, you can get some variation or sensitivity to the variation of the charge radius in lithium. You can also look at the hyperfine structure, and the hyperfine structure is also sensitive to the charge radius, but in addition, it's sensitive to something called the Zamach radius. So what the Zamach radius is it's the distribution of your electric form factor, right? Your normalized charge density times the normalized magnetic dipole charge density or magnetic dipole density. Integrated over the first moment over both of these parameters. So basically, the Zamach radius is telling you something about how the magnetic distribution is inside the nucleus. Okay, so here's some of the low-lying energies of lithium. And what I want to focus on today is these first two states, right? These excitations from the 2s to the 2p states. So if we zoom in on those states, we see the fine structure splitting, and the fine structure splitting is relatively small, right? Because, again, the fine structure splitting is coming from a relativistic correction, and the electrons in lithium aren't moving too fast because it's a small atom. So it's about 10 gigahertz. And if we include the effect of nuclear spin, then we get some hyperfine structure splitting. The ground state splitting is around 800 megahertz. And I guess the important thing from this picture is really that this upper state splitting is quite small. Right? The upper state splitting is smaller than the natural line width of the states. The natural line width of this 2p 3/2 state is about 6 megahertz. And the splitting up here ranges from 2.8 up around to 9.4. So that's going to end up being an important challenge with these types of experiments. Lithium-6 looks similar. Lithium-6 has a non-zero nuclear spin, and it also has an unresolved splitting in the upper state. And by sort of an unfortunate accident, the isotope shifts are almost exactly the same as the fine structure splitting. They're also about 10 gigahertz. And it's so close, in fact, that the 2p 3/2 state overlaps with some of the transitions in the d1 to the 2p 1/2 state for the other isotope. So these are the types of energies we're looking to measure, right? These 10 gigahertz splittings. So this has been done before. This is not really a new idea. And here's a couple of the measurements that have done the fine structure splitting. So these are the most precise ones. There are a few others. And if you look, this the agreement's pretty poor. I actually think the agreement looks a little better than it should. These points A and B are the same group, and they were analyzing basically the same set of data. The A is a reanalysis of the data they used in B, plus they added a little bit more data in B. And they don't agree that well, considering that it's largely the same set of data. So there's a lot of disagreement here in the measurements. So why? What's going on? Why is this such a hard measurement? Well, there's a few reasons. One is that it's a large frequency split. 10 gigahertz is difficult to measure with traditional sort of spectroscopic techniques that don't use a frequency cone. So I should say that if we go back to this picture here, the only two, or the only measurement, because it is just one measurement, that used the frequency cone was A and B. These others were done without a frequency cone. C was done with a reference cavity, and D and E were done in other ways. All right, so we got a large frequency splitting. The other reason it's so hard is because of this unresolved hyperfine splitting in the excited state. And this was a problem that I think people didn't realize was such a big problem until this latest group, Craig Santinetti at NIST and Gaithersburg, pointed this out. And the issue here is that if you have an unresolved hyperfine structure, you get an interference in the fluorescence distribution. And this interference is sort of insidious, right? I mean, so it's happening because if you think about a scattering process from state I to state F, you have to sum over all the intermediate states, state J. And if your state's J, which is your excited state, to overlap, then you get interference between the different contributions. And the reason this is so difficult is that it gives you a non-Lorentzian contribution to the line shape. And of course, this is it depends on the angle of the polarization that's scattered and the angle of the polarization and the angle of the relative to the angle of excitation.
So it's like point structure B, basically.
Basically, yeah. And if you integrate it over the solid angle, then it wouldn't be there. But you don't do that typically. What you typically would do is you would take your atoms, you would excite them with some linearly polarized light, and you look in some direction. And so what ends up happening then is you get this sensitivity to this angle between the detection and the polarization of the excitation. So for dipole scattering, we can always write the fluorescence as some symmetric component plus some component that goes as the second order Legendre polynomial, your dipole term. And this unresolved lines mean that these fluorescence patterns interfere because the ratio of B to A is different for the different hyperfine states. Right? If A and B were the same for all the hyperfine states, or the ratio were the same for all the hyperfine states, there wouldn't be a problem. But since the ratio is different, the contribution ends up being a little more complicated, and you end up with these apparent shifts of the line center. So this is a picture that I got from Roger Brown, who worked up on the experiment at NIST. And the black shows the line shape model, or the line shape that you would expect if you do the calculation right, if you include this interference effect. And the red shows what you would get if you didn't include the calculation, and this blue is this correction term. And you can see there's a clear shift between the red peaks and the black peaks, and that's not due to this non-Lorentzian contribution. All right, so this is a big effect, and this isn't really new. I mean, people have known this for a long time, but they sort of forgot about it in the context of these measurements. And most of the other measurements did not include this effect. So this is great, right? So then these people got it right, everything's good. Except that it's not quite. There's still some issues with the discrepancy. Because if we look at the 2p state and let's look at the isotope shift for the D1 transition, the state to the transition to the 2p1 half state, well, the disagreement's very poor here as well. So again, we've got the NIST group in Gaithersburg at this point there, and then these other groups who seem to disagree quite a bit. And this transition is totally unresolved. You know, the splittings are 26 megahertz and 90 megahertz. So there's no issue there. And we still don't have very good agreement. So the experiments are hard. I mean, they're surprisingly hard for just a simple spectroscopy experiment. We can look at where theory is at. And the theory is pretty good. Petrolsky and Pruchecki have done these calculations, and they just came out with this calculation, which is not yet published, but is on the archive, and their result comes in reasonably well within agreement of the NIST Gaithersburg result. So it's looking like maybe maybe things are going well, but it's a little hard to say at this point. These theory points have moved around in much the same way that the experimental points are. So I think this is a system that sort of needs to be beat on a little bit more in order to really resolve these results. So just for quick reference, the nuclear structure effects, which you're really sensitive to, is the difference between these charge radii of the two isotopes. And you can see sort of the accuracies that you can get from these states. And you can also see that there's been a measurement of the 2s to 3s transition, and you can get the charge radii separation from the isotope shifts of that state of transition as well. And one final note on the sort of the current status of this is that the nucleus looks interesting, or the nuclei look interesting. The charge radius of lithium-6 is larger than the charge radius of lithium-7, which you can see from these the minus sign in these values here. But the Zamach radius is quite a bit smaller in lithium-6 than it is in lithium-7. So there seems to be a very interesting variation of the way the magnetization is distributed in the nuclei compared to the charges. And these are numbers are coming from the Sansonetti NIST group and the theory of Puchalski and Puchicki. Okay, so what can we contribute to this? Well, as I say, the experiment seems pretty simple. We have an atomic beam right now, and we send light, and we excite the light with a laser, which is stabilized to a stable frequency cone, which is then steered to this rubidium clock. So the things that we get is, of course, the absolute frequency cone control of the cone. And the one thing that I think the advantage we'll have over the NIST measurement is that we are stabilizing our diode laser. So the NIST measurement actually did not stabilize their diode laser, the laser that's probing the transition. They left that free running and just scanned the transition and then counted the frequency by interfering it with the comb. And the reason they did that was just because they didn't have time and they had to wrap things up. It wasn't because they overlooked that or anything. They just weren't able to do it in the time allotted to them. So that actually gets you a lot in terms of systematics, because you get rid of all any frequency noise and the probe laser, and you can really control the frequency and calibrate it in an absolute way at all times. And the hope for this is that we'll get some preliminary results with the atomic beam and then move on to laser cool and trap the atoms. That will also reduce the systematic effects associated with the motion of the atoms and allow us to push the uncertainties a little bit better. So I'm hoping that the combination of the laser cooling and the frequency control will allow us to do a factor of 5 or so better than the NIST results and say something a little more competitive about this. So what does it look like? Well, this is a frequency comb. It's a homemade frequency comb. It's a Thai sapphire mode lock laser, and it's 4 mirrors. It's sort of deceptively simple looking. The crystal's in this copper housing. And it has a rep rate, which is rather large. It's about 920 megahertz. So it's a high rep rate comb, which is good for spectroscopy because it gives you more power per frequency mode. And we broaden the spectrum using these photonic crystal fibers, which are these magical fibers where you send in infrared light and you get out everything. And you can sort of see that process happening as it goes through the fiber. And we get an optical spectrum which spans from about 500 nanometers to 1.1 microns. Diode laser is just a conventional extended cavity diode laser. We got quite a bit of power out of it now, and it can scan for large ranges, and we can stabilize it to the comb with relatively narrow line widths. So we've done some spectroscopy. Our original plan was to look at saturated fluorescence spectroscopy to get sub-Doppler line widths. And the advantage of this is that it gets you it reduces some sensitivity to misalignments of the atomic beam, because you're by doing the saturated fluorescence approach, you really are assured that you're interrogating only the zero velocity class. So you can see our signal. So this signal took about 10 minutes or so of a scan, 5 to 10 minutes. And we fit this then to a Doppler background and then subtract the background, and we can see the sub-Doppler features. This ends up being not really a great way to do this experiment, I think, and mainly because of the crossover resonances and the density of the transitions that we have. We have so many transitions and so many crossover resonances that the decoupling it all and trying to figure out what the spectrum really means is a little bit challenging. So we've actually gone ahead and narrowed the atomic beam and narrowed the Doppler width. And we're in the process of collecting data and evaluating our systematic effects, which of course is really the hard part of this. Right? But we know what we're looking for and have some idea of how to control all of these systematic effects at sort of the 10 to 20 kilohertz level. So in the future, as I said, we want to cool and trap the atoms to reduce the Doppler motion effects. But also, we'd like to extend study to more higher lying states of lithium. So most of these states haven't been studied in a long time. The 3S state, as I showed you, that the data has been studied recently. But the 3D states and the 4D states and the 4S states haven't been studied as extensively. So I think we can make a significant contribution to sort of understanding the spectra of lithium in a more complete way. Oberlin is an undergraduate-only institution, so there's a number of undergraduates who've kind of come through and then gone off to bigger and better things. And this is sort of a list of all the students who've worked in the lab since I've been there. This work is supported by the early part of it was supported by the National Institute of Standards and Technology Precision Measurements Grant, and now has an NSF grant for the project. So, thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to comment that there is no surprise that the charge radius of lithium 6 is larger than the charge radius of lithium 7 because it's roughly about state of deuterium, which is large, right? On top of helium 4, and helium 3 is small. Tritium is smaller than deuterium, which is on top of helium 4. And also, there is no surprise that Zmach radius is in reverse because it's set by the integral that saturates on the smaller scales for lithium 7, so it makes sense actually from nuclear point of view.
Yeah.
Are there QED calculations for these states?
For these states, not that I know of, not yet. So those are challenging.
For some reason, QED people.
No. Papuski had some talk at demo.
For the D states?
For D states?
Yeah.
Where the upper states you were.
So we'll look at. We'll look at the 3D and the 4D.
Yeah.
States.
Yeah. So, no.
Yeah.
3D calculations for D states.
Yeah. They're hard. Much harder. Yeah.
So I think. From the hyperfine structure, you could get octopole nuclear moments. Are you at that level of accuracy? I mean, is there a hope?
You know, you'd only see that on the P3 half state.
Right, yeah.
And given the unresolved spectra, it's going to be pretty tough. I won't say no totally, because if we laser cool and trap it, we might be able to control the overlap well enough. For the NIST Gaithersburg measurements, they actually didn't even bother trying to measure the hyperfine structure. They took the hyperfine structure and fixed it from the calculations and then used that and it did not fit those parameters. So it's a difficult thing to do. But I think if we laser cool and trap it, it's possible, but it's going to be pretty challenging.
That comb stability plot early on in your talk was quite impressive, and I guess, I don't know if this is a question to the audience again, but I mean, it seems like, wow, you've got some sort of measurement device that's more
right.
stable than an atomic clock. Maybe there's some fundamental measurement that could be done just by
right.
through the comb stability itself somehow. I don't know.
I mean, it tells you how good the doubling process is, right? It's hard to see what that would be because it would violate energy conservation. But I don't know.
Two questions. One is magic angle.
Would yes, exactly. The magic angle helps a lot. And if you go to the magic angle, it's just pure Lorentzians. And that's actually how they discovered the effect. They were fitting their data and they didn't get good fits. And so then they just took it as a function of polarization angle because that's a knob that can change. And they saw, hey, it goes away. The residuals are flat at a magic angle. And so that's an easy way to do it. The problem is that you don't detect just one angle. You have a finite solid angle. And so you really have to integrate over that whole solid angle and deal with that.
Now, you have some lines that are resolved and more or less, and some lines that are less resolved.
Yeah.
but you don't really need to look at all of them. You can actually extract like hyperfine parameters, for example, for the ones that are well resolved, and the other one just, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what the NIST group did. Yeah, you can definitely do that if you're willing to believe the theory and just use it with. And the theory is very good at predicting those at sort of the level of accuracy that we're.
More questions? All right, then let's thank you.